From Michigan Radio, this is State of Opportunity. I'm Jennifer Guerra. I'm standing in a place that no parent wants to find themselves in. I'm surrounded by lots of rooms with incubators and feeding tubes and tiny, tiny little babies. It's the neonatal intensive care unit, also known as
the NICU.
And I'm here with
Robert, call me Bob Schumacher. And I'm the medical director of the newborn intensive care unit at the University of Michigan. I'm a neonatologist. That's a fancy name for a pediatrician who plays in the newborn intensive care unit all day.
Can you tell me sort of what are the more common reasons why babies end up in the NICU?
Well, in most intensive care units across the country and in the state of Michigan, most babies are here because they're early. They're premature. The other reason we get a lot of babies here at the University of Michigan is because of congenital and problems with congenital anomalies. A baby who has a heart or an intestine or some organ system that's not built right. So prematurity, congenital anomalies are the two causes of infant mortality, big causes.
What do you tell parents when they come in here? I know it's different for every case, but I wonder if there is something you say that either calms them or gives them hope.
Well, yeah, I will often say, you know, it's a two-edged sword. I'm congratulations on the birth of your child, and I'm sorry you're here. The survival rate of most of our babies, even down to very little teeny tiny babies, is well into the 90% range, which if you were a parent, you'd say, oh, that's much better than I thought. But I'll think to myself, that means if it's 90%, one in 10 of you won't make it. The sad news is, oftentimes you don't know which one it is that isn't going to make it. That is, all the babies that you're taking care of are doing fine. Until one day, you walk in and you go, oh no. It's like a meteor came down and just landed right in the middle of a baby's room.
Michael was born at 26 weeks, 1 pound, 4 ounces. He was so small that my husband could put his wedding ring on his wrist. And he lived to be 11 and a half months old. And he came home. We enjoyed him at home for 4 months before he passed away on a ventilator with a trach. And he had a feeding tube. It was definitely an emotional roller coaster. You know, in NICU, everything is something to hold on to. So if he drank 1 ounce of breast milk, that was, you know, a great accomplishment for him. So for him to live that long when the doctor said that he wouldn't even make it 24 hours was a blessing.
That was Ebony Evans at a park in Metro Detroit, talking about her son, Mikhail Javon Evans. Ebony and her husband now have a healthy and happy 6-year-old daughter named Essence. So, like Dr. Schumacher said, two of the main reasons babies end up in the NICU is because they're born too soon or too small. And a disproportionate amount of preterm and low birth weight babies are African American.
If white babies died at the rate black babies died, we would have a national emergency.
Dr. Carolyn Rowland runs the Maternal Infant Health Program for the city of Detroit, and she's part of a team of public health workers who get together once a month to talk about the ways to reduce the city's black infant mortality rate. She says the story of infant mortality doesn't start in the NICU. She says it starts much, much earlier.
Growing up, a woman of color in this society is toxic. Yes. It's toxic to you, to your physical health, your emotional health, your mental health, and therefore that impacts your reproductive capacity. So if, in fact, we really cared about all of our children, we would not allow women of color to grow up in a toxic soup.
Roland's toxic soup metaphor, part racism, part poverty, part inequity, isn't some fringe idea that she and a few liberal lefties cooked up. The data show that moms with little or no income, moms who live in troubled neighborhoods, moms who don't finish high school, and moms who receive inadequate prenatal care, they're all more likely to lose a child. But there's also a growing body of research that implicates racism in the black and white infant mortality disparity.
Hi, Jennifer.
Hello. How are you?
How are you?
That's Dr. Renee Branch Kamady. She heads up the Ingham County Health Department. Before that, she was a research professor at Michigan State University, where she did lots of studies on race and health disparities. Kamady, who, it seems worth noting, is black, lives in Lansing with her youngest son, 17-year-old Wesley. That's him playing piano. I met up with them at their house on a Saturday afternoon. It was chore day at the Kamady household.
Putting all the furniture back. We just finished getting the deck power washed and stained. Honey, the heavy one, is that the heavy one?
Wesley's two older brothers are away at college, so lucky them, they get out of doing the household chores. But there is one other person missing from this scene. And that's Kamady's firstborn son.
My fourth son, my deceased son, is Mark Howard. We refer to him as Howard, used his middle name. This is my son.
Kamady takes out a little photo album and starts showing me pictures of Mark Howard.
I know, I'm just a sweetie pie.
He was born premature.
Yeah, so this was his team, his nurse and all the neonatologists.
And he passed away when he was just 6 months old. It happened right around the time Kamady went to grad school. So there she was, working on her dissertation. And the whole time, she kept turning the pregnancy over and over in her mind, asking herself,
what should I have done differently? What could I have done differently?
Those are very personal questions, and they ultimately ended up playing out in Kamady's professional life. By the time Kamady finished her PhD and joined Michigan State as a research professor, her focus was clear. She wanted to know why African-American babies have significantly worse outcomes than white infants.
Even when we controlled for economic status, there was still this unexplained difference in the pregnancy outcomes of women of color versus white women. And when the literature began to demonstrate that African-American women who were college educated still had worse outcomes than white women who had no high school diploma. And so with that, you begin to say, what is distinct in the lives of African-American women?
There's pretty strong evidence that genetics do not play a role in the disparity. So what does? Well, over the past two decades, lots of different theories have been presented and rejected. One that seems to be gaining more and more traction, though, is something called the social determinants of health.
Social determinants are those economic, social, contextual factors that influence a woman's ability to have a healthy pregnancy or to engage in the healthy behaviors needed to have a favorable pregnancy outcome.
In other words, where you live, work, and play, it all contributes to your chances of delivering a healthy baby. So let's say you live in a high-poverty urban neighborhood. You are more likely to go to a low-performing school. You're more likely to be exposed to drugs and violence, which can be stressful. You're less likely to have a nearby park or a place to exercise, less likely to have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, and less likely to have good medical care. It all translates to less opportunity for the people living in these neighborhoods, many of whom are black.
I mean, I always say the choices people make are determined by the choices people have. And many women live in settings where they don't have very good choices, or when good choices are available, they don't have the ability to respond because of a variety of social barriers in their lives.
Kamady believes one of the biggest barriers women of color face is racism and the chronic stress that goes along with that discrimination. Not blatant, in-your-face racism. Kennedy says that's pretty rare these days. No, what she's talking about is more subtle. She calls it interpersonal racism, and she believes it's taking its toll on women's health. The effect of all that stress, it has a name. It's called weathering, and it was coined by this woman.
My name is Arlene Geronimus, and I'm a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan.
When Arlene Geronimus first published her weathering hypothesis in the 1980s, it didn't go over too well.
I was actually called at one point the biggest threat to youth in this country.
Today, her weathering hypothesis has gained a lot more traction. So here's her theory. Women of color experience chronic stress related to being Black and how they're treated. And these stressors over time, it prematurely ages the women or weathers them. So that by the time African-American women are in their 20s or early 30s, often considered prime childbearing years, their health has deteriorated so much that they're at greater risk for having a poor birth outcome, like premature birth or low birth weight.
Chronic stress means you're endlessly flooded with stress hormones. They don't go back to normal levels, and they do damage, you know, to your heart, to your blood pressure, to, you know, to your weight, to all, a variety of things we see as either precursors to poor health or our poor health themselves.
And weathering doesn't just take its toll on poor Black women. Geronimus says rich and middle-class African-American women experience it as well.
They're still dealing with stressors related to the contingencies of being Black and how they're treated. They're dealing with being tokens. They're dealing with having been raised in one way and then being part of a kind of institution that has unwritten, unspoken rules that you didn't get the memo, but everybody else seems to have the memo.
You're listening to State of Opportunity. I'm Jennifer Guerra. We're looking at why infant mortality and infant mortality disparities are such a big problem in Michigan. There are a number of studies that implicate racism, broadly defined, in infant mortality disparities. Studies that compare white and Black mothers who lived in high-income neighborhoods, Black and Hispanic mothers who lived in low-income neighborhoods, Black and white moms who were obese. Across the board, Black mothers were at an increased risk for losing a child. But Harvard Health economist Amitabh Chandra isn't buying it. He says there is a lot more work that needs to be done before we can point the finger at racism and say it's a major cause in infant mortality disparities.
The bar for having demonstrated racism is much higher than saying, even when I control for, poverty status and college degree, there are persistent gaps in infant mortality. That doesn't tell me that it's racism. It just tells me I didn't do a particularly good job of measuring the quality of schooling or neighborhood circumstance. Now, maybe to some people that's racism, but to me it just means there's lots of other things in life we have to control for.
Blaming racism, he says, is a little premature. Chandra's open to the hypothesis that racism plays a part in infant mortality disparities. But in the end, he says, it's just that. A hypothesis.
I think we need to do a lot more work to understand exactly how racism and the experience of discrimination, how that affects, say, early onset of aging or stress or hypertension. I think we need to do more work there. I think what we have is a hypothesis with some really intriguing evidence around it, but I don't think we have like evidence that rises to the level of having firmly determined that this is why we see what we do.
To Chandra, things like education, neighborhoods, behaviors, those are things that can be empirically measured and have been shown to have an impact on health disparities. He is much less convinced that racism at the health provider level plays a big role in the disparities. But don't tell that to the people in this room.
Okay. Thinking over all the things that you saw and heard in the film, what stands out to you as particularly surprising or important?
About 15 people, mostly middle-aged, are sitting in a semicircle in the middle of a room in Charlotte, near Lansing. They've just finished watching part of a documentary which explores whether or not inequality makes people sick. The two people leading the health equity workshop are
Valerie Smith
and Doak Bloss.
They're with the Ingham County Health Department. The goal of their four-day workshop is to teach public health workers to treat everyone the same, regardless of race, age, or gender. The workshop is mandatory for everyone who works for the county's health department. Accountants, nutritionists, and medical staff, everybody has to participate. About 200 state-level public health workers have also taken the workshop.
Basically, we have these huge disparities that exist for people of color when compared to white people, for people of low socioeconomic status to higher socioeconomic status. And those disparities are consistent across populations, across the country. Infant mortality is one of the most obvious ones. In Ingham County, we've had as many as the rate has been five times higher that an African-American baby will die than a white baby.
To get at the root causes of why these disparities exist, Doak Bloss's workshop tackles all the biggies: racism, class discrimination, sexism. They talk about how those things can impact health and what to do about it. To help illustrate his point, Bloss likes to use a metaphor. So imagine two people standing on two different ladders. One person is doing better. They're higher up on the ladder.
The person who's doing better, that's a disparity. That's like the outcome is different for these two groups of people.
To talk about inequity, Bloss says you have to look at the ladder itself. The person who's doing better has a better ladder. The rungs are closer, so it's easier to climb.
Whereas the person on the ladder that has very few rungs is hanging on for dear life, can't think of how to get to that next thing, and some people have to work 10 times harder to get up that ladder. That's inequity. That's an unjust, unfair difference in opportunity, difference in access to resources.
Bloss isn't delusional. He understands that disparities in infant mortality and other health issues, they aren't going to vanish all of a sudden because of one mandatory four-day workshop. But he says conversations are happening at his health department and at the state level that didn't used to happen. People are asking, are we treating our patients the way they need to be treated given their life circumstances? Change is not going to happen overnight. But if Doak Bloss were a betting man,
I would say it's a 20-year effort, honestly, to change the culture in the way that we want to.
But 20 years is a long time and a lot of potential lives lost. So what can be done now? What's happening today to ensure that all babies have an equal shot at celebrating their first birthday, no matter where they live, what color their skin is, how much money their parents have in the bank? Coming up, we'll look at a program that's trying to reduce infant mortality, not just by addressing what happens inside the hospital, but in the neighborhoods as well.
So, for instance, to address infant mortality, you provide the ability for women to have access to fresh fruits and vegetables in their neighborhood. Well, guess what? Other people in the neighborhood are going to benefit from access to fresh fruits and vegetables. If you have a safe environment where they can, you know, move more, guess what? The whole community benefits. The men, families, all of these different things, factors that we use that will help decrease the infant mortality rate are the same factors that will actually lift the whole a whole community in terms of its health status.
Solutions to the infant mortality problem, coming up in 10 minutes. You're listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio.